Feeling stressed, left without gravity, in an environment that gets more and more complicated and complex every day? Untangle your mind and go back to the roots of clear thinking. Get the original text of The Leviathan by Hobbes, The Two Treatises of Government by Locke, The Social Contract by Rousseau, plus the U.S. Constitution from Pennsylvania, bound together into just one practical book. That's right, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, and the U.S. Constitution, bound together into just one practical book to keep your costs low.
We have a lot to talk about, and we only have you for an hour, so I want to get to it. I think the main thing that I want to get out of you tonight is you seem to play this game differently than everybody else. There's in the history of Silicon Valley, there's only one guy who's created three companies that were worth more than $1 billion each, and that's Jim Clark. And he did it with Silicon Graphics, right, legitimate company, Netscape, legitimate company, and Healthion, which never right, would have been a $1 billion company right, without a bubble.
True.
But all sort of in the same industry.
Yeah.
You've done it, if we count SpaceX, even though it hasn't exited, but it has a multi-billion-dollar contract, so I think we can count it as more than $1 billion, right?
Yeah, SpaceX is a private, yeah, I mean, it's
safe
private
to
say market valuation, sort of a couple billion dollars.
So, right. Yeah. So you're the only other guy who's done it, and you've done it with payments, probably one of the hardest industries to disrupt on the web, cars, and going to space.
Right. Yeah.
So what do you do differently?
SolarCity's later this year, by the way.
But do you count as a co-founder for that one?
No, actually, they offered to have me be listed as a co-founder, but I thought that, although I had suggested the initial idea, I did not put enough sort of sweat equity into it to be considered such.
You should have been, because you could have been the first guy with four.
I think there's sort of a certain threshold of idea contribution and initial effort that's required for that. That's sort of, you know, I mean, it's sort of subjective, but I don't think I did enough.
Right.
They did offer it to me, but I said no.
So it is part of the reason you've done this that you are sort of crazy? Are you lucky?
I've been thinking about that lately. and I sort of wonder, I think I probably am a bit crazy. But maybe that's sort of a healthy sign, because at the point at which you conclude you're not crazy at all, then you probably are.
So the fact that you realize
it's sort of a recursive
a
thing, yeah.
There's one story that I've heard about you.
Do
that,
I seem crazy?
Yes,
I've always
said that about you.
Okay.
Here's the story that made me think you were crazy.
Okay.
And you can tell me if this
does it involve the New York Times?
No.
Okay.
No. Elon got me in so much trouble several years ago, and he called someone a douchebag and a liar, and I started laughing and never lived
actually,
it down.
Actually, to be precise, douchebag and an idiot.
We actually said a liar. We cut out the liar.
Oh, did I really?
Yeah, because we thought it would be libelous. That part we cut.
Okay, yeah. Well, I think that may... Well, I guess that's probably true, too, but I think it's more the first two, yeah.
More the first two.
Yeah.
So, this is the story that made me think you were crazy.
Yeah.
I heard right after you sold PayPal, before the other two companies, you went and bought a McLaren S1.
Because F1, yes.
F1, sorry. that's the same part.
So, right,
partially because you were going to race cars with Jim Clark and Larry Ellison.
No, actually, and I never did. Although that was one of the things that was sort of talked about at one point, but I never did.
In fact, I've
never raced anyone with McLaren. I had it for several years, and I put 11,000 miles on it, and I drove it from LA to San Francisco. It was my daily driver, which is a crazy car to have as a daily driver, particularly on the 405.
So, but I understand when you got it,
yeah,
you're driving down 280, and you wrecked it.
No,
let me just tell the story, and
okay,
you can correct it. Because
right,
the story is great, and I mean,
yeah, let's see if the story that you tell is actually, how that compares to the reality, because the reality is pretty messed up.
So, hopefully the reality's better. So you wreck the car, you get out of the car, you're doubling over with laughter. And the
really?
Person with you said, why are you laughing that you just wrecked this car? And you said, no, you don't know the funny part. It wasn't insured.
Well, the punchline's correct.
um,
Yeah, so I was actually, I was driving up Sand Hill Road with Peter Thiel, the co-founders of PayPal. We're actually driving to see Mike Moritz. This is in 2000. And so we're driving up Sand Hill Road. I didn't really know how to drive the McLaren. And Peter says, so what can this do? And then like, I'm probably number one on the list of famous last words. I said, watch this. So I floored it. I floored it and did a lane change on Sand Hill. And so the McLaren has no traction control or anything. It was just, it's massive power to the wheels, sort of 640 brake horsepower, and it only weighs a ton. So it has massive power to weight. It can brake the wheels free at 80 miles an hour. So broke the rear end free and started spinning. I was going straight and then turned, and I remember seeing the cars coming towards me while I was going backwards. And then we hit an embankment, sort of a 45 degree embankment on Sand Hill, which tossed the car into the air like a discus. And it kept rotating with about 3 foot of air clearance, according to witnesses. and then slammed down on the ground, going the original direction. And we blew the suspension out. Now, it didn't actually wreck the car. The core chassis and the engine were okay.
Thank God.
But all the glass and the wheels and everything was shredded, and there was massive body damage in the front and rear.
And did you start laughing?
I don't recall laughing. I could have been laughing in shock, but I don't recall laughing. And then Peter hitched a ride to Mike. I waited while the fire truck and the ambulance arrived. And then finally
did Peter Thiel literally hitch a ride
over to Sequoia to, yeah, and then once the car was taken care of, then I hitched a ride too, and we continued the meeting.
I'm picturing you and Peter Thiel like that scene in Tommy Boy, where like the deer, and you're both like
yeah, really.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is there a parallel?
Lucky to be alive, really.
I should say so.
Yeah.
Is there a parallel with how you build companies in that story?
I hope not.
Let's see what this thing can do.
Watch this. That could be awkward with a rocket launch. it's one thing if you've got a one-ton car versus a million pounds of TNT equivalent.
That is a little dicier.
Yeah.
Now, what I think is one of the things I find so interesting about you, the rest of the PayPal guys, they get done with PayPal, they start starting and investing in Web 2.0 companies at a point in time when everyone said, that's insane. That's insane. The internet will never come back. They were considered the crazy ones. Meanwhile, you move to LA and start working on SolarCity, SpaceX, Tesla's a glint in your eye.
Yeah.
Will you ever do an internet company again? Do you find the internet boring?
I think it's unlikely that I'll do an internet company again because, not that I find the internet boring. I mean, I'm still sort of, I think I'm relatively sort of net savvy and interested in the internet and what's going on. I don't ever want to be the grandpa who doesn't do email or something like that, you know? But I think I'm trying to allocate my efforts to that which I think would most affect the future of humanity in a positive way. And I think there's lots of entrepreneurial energy and financing headed towards the internet, whereas in certain sectors like automotive and solar and space, you don't see new entrants. There's not a lot of capital going to startups, and not a lot of entrepreneurs going into those arenas. And the problem is that in the absence of some new entrants into an industry, you don't have that force for innovation. It's really new entrants that drive innovation more than anything. Mm-hmm. That's why I have devoted my efforts to those industries. And there are industries that require, as I said, quite a bit of capital to get going. Mm-hmm. And even with SpaceX, I mean, my proceeds from PayPal after tax were about $180 million. 100 of that went into SpaceX, 70 into Tesla, and 10 into SolarCity. And I literally had to borrow money for rent. That was
a close
call.
Was that the plan?
Or? No, that was not the plan.
So what was the plan? You thought, oh, let's put 10 in each of these? Or?
Well, actually, I thought, for SpaceX, I thought it would be about, well, I guess I was probably about double. It ended up being double in most cases. So with SpaceX, I thought it would be 50. With Tesla, I thought I'd be putting in 25, maybe 30. With SolarCity, SolarCity actually went really well. And that's the one where I wasn't a co-founder, so maybe that's a good sign. I should co-found less stuff.
So what happened? Yeah. Why did you have to put more money in the other two? Or did investors flake? Did you have?
Well, I didn't actually seek investor funding for the first three rounds of SpaceX. The first thing that investors want to ask you is sort of, well, tell us about prior successes in this field. What could we compare this to? There's, you know, when you've got kind of the donut in the success category and a lot of, you know, a cemetery full of failures, then they're not that keen. And I mean, rockets are just pretty far out of the comfort zone of most venture capitalists. Now we were able to get venture funding after we've made some progress and demonstrated that we were able to almost get to orbit. Mm-hmm. Credit goes to sort of to Founders Fund, and which is obviously some of my compatriots from PayPal, Peter Thiel and Luke Nosek and Ken Howery and the other guys. Mm-hmm. So. They invested before we got to orbit, so credit to them for that. But I did have to show that I could actually make stuff. Like I never actually made physical stuff before, mm-hmm. Before SpaceX. So let alone rockets.
So you started with a rocket.
Yeah, I mean that's a hard one, it's the probability of success was low. In fact, when I started SpaceX, I thought that the most likely outcome was failure. And I think to have any other expectation would have been irrational. So
why did you want to do it? I know for Tesla it seems more obvious, like, oh, save the planet, big automakers aren't doing this. I mean, I think it's sort of fairly obvious that's good for humanity. Why did you feel like SpaceX needed to be done?
Well, I guess if you look at the trajectory of space technology and progress, The pinnacle of that progress was around maybe 1969, 1970, mm-hmm. With the moon missions, and so we made incredible progress in the 60s, and then we were able to land on the moon, and then with the space shuttle we could only get people to low Earth orbit. Now the space shuttle is retired, and that's just there's no trajectory of improvement. It's a trajectory to nothing. Mm-hmm. So. And I kept thinking that there'd be some plan to send people to Mars because that's the obvious next step. And the actual origin of SpaceX is when I was, I think it was around 2001 or so, and I was visiting a friend of mine, Adair Ressi, who actually you may have met, mm-hmm. but he lives in Palo Alto now. We were college housemates. And he asked me what I was going to do after PayPal, and I said, well, I've always been interested in space. But I didn't think that there was anything I could do in space as an individual. So my initial plan in space was actually to do a small mission to Mars with a greenhouse, essentially seasoned dehydrated nutrient gel in a little greenhouse that would land, and you'd hydrate the gel, and then you'd grow the plants, and you'd have this great shot of green plants in a red background, and that would be the money shot, essentially. The people tend to respond to precedents and superlatives, and this would be the furthest that life's ever traveled, the first life on Mars, as far as we know. And that would get people excited, and I thought, well, that would result in an increased NASA budget, and then we could send people to Mars, because that's, you know, I think you want to have a future where you're expecting things to be better, not one where you're expecting things to be worse. Mm-hmm. So that was how things started out, and then as I learned more, and I went to, speaking of crazy things, went to Russia three times to negotiate a deal to buy a couple of the largest ICBMs in the Russian fleet. A strange experience.
How do you even get into that negotiation?
Well, you talk to people who know people, and pretty soon you're talking to the Russian rocket forces, and you know, they. It turns out Russia is quite a capitalist society, but it definitely has had some weird meetings in places like that. I swear they looked like a sanitarium or something. I don't know. It was very odd.
We keep going back to the theme of crazy.
Yeah. Seriously, this place had padded walls. You're like, why do you have padded walls? It was weird. And then I had some sort of Russian guy who was missing a front tooth started yelling at me because one of his front teeth was missing. He was like spit flying at me in a place with padded walls. I'm like, this is really bizarre.
What's happened to my life?
Right.
And that was the moment when you thought, I'm going to build my own rocket.
Yeah. That was probably, when I got back from that third trip, I was like, I realized that the real issue, the reason we haven't advanced in space is because the cost of space transportation has become unaffordable. You know, it's become more and more expensive to do less and less in space. Mm-hmm. And we really need to improve the technology of space transportation. So that's why I started SpaceX. Mm-hmm. But it may seem odd that I would start SpaceX with an expectation of failure. But bear in mind that my initial thing was to do essentially a philanthropic mission with a 0% chance of success from a financial standpoint. So it would have effectively been a donation to the cause. Mm-hmm. And so anything better than that is a win.
Right, right. So, you know, I know people think of you as someone who's had a lot of success, but you had several failures within SpaceX before the recent launch. Can you tell us a little bit about what it's like to put that much work into something and be doing something that really no one else is doing?
Yeah.
And at least trying something and putting that much of your own money in it, that you're having to borrow money from friends to pay your rent, and there are launches and it's failing.
Yeah, it super sucks. I have to tell you. That was 2008 in particular was awful because we had the third launch failure in a row of our Falcon 1 vehicle at SpaceX. The Tesla financing round that we were raising fell apart because the economy was going to tailspin. And it's pretty hard to raise money for a startup car company, you know, late 2008 when GM and Chrysler are busy going bankrupt. Mm-hmm. That was tough. And then SolarCity had to deal with Morgan Stanley, and Morgan Stanley had to renege on the deal because they themselves were running out of money. It looked like all three companies were going to die. Mm-hmm. And I was also going through a divorce. So that was definitely a low point. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, the fourth launch worked.
Did you think the third launch was going to work? Was it a shock that it didn't?
I thought it would I thought the odds of it working were better than 50%. Mm-hmm. There was just a little change in the thrust transient of the first stage engine that resulted in we couldn't see it on the ground because of the thrust transient. Well, to get slightly technical for a second, the pressure decay on the thrust transient dropped below sea level pressure. Mm-hmm. So when you look at it on the test stand, at sea level, you don't see it. It doesn't look like there's a thrust transient. And because we changed the architecture of the engine to one that was regeneratively cooled instead of ablatively cooled, it had this little tiny transient, which caused the first stage to ram the upper stage, and the upper stage engine started inside the interstage section. Mm-hmm. Like it's like sort of firing at this engine indoors. Mm-hmm. with a big plasma blowback that fried the upper stage.
Wow.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that.
So it's 2008, you're going through a divorce, which like some, to borrow your word, douchebag bloggers are writing about to make even worse.
Right, yes, that's true. In addition to all that stuff happening, I was getting dumped on massively in the press.
Right.
Yeah.
It looks like all three companies
yeah.
are going to fail. I mean, why do you keep going with all three? Like, I feel like even a lot of great entrepreneurs in that situation would have been like, I've already sunk everything I have in these companies, and I got to pick one. But you didn't. I mean, you kept doing all three. Why?
That was a very tough call. At the end of 2008, that was probably the tough, you know, one of the toughest calls I've had to make, because I could either reserve capital for one company or the other. I mean, fortunately, SolarCity didn't need a ton of capital, so they were okay. But between SpaceX and Tesla, you know, it's sort of like if you've got two kids, and what do? Do you spend all your money to maximize the probability of success of one, or do you try to keep both alive? Fortunately, it worked.
You also had to step back in as the CEO of Tesla.
Yeah. My goal was never to be the CEO of Tesla. From the beginning, I mean, I had an interest in electric cars that goes back 20 years to, you know, when I was in college. In fact, I used to talk to my dates about electric cars. It's probably not the best strategy.
Close those dates.
No. I usually have to stop talking about that. I've had a long-standing interest in electric cars, since I was doing SpaceX, I knew that if I did try to start an electric car company and run it, that it would be extremely painful to run two companies. So I really tried my hardest not to be the CEO of Tesla. I mean, at any point from day one, I could have been the CEO because I had majority control of the company.
Right.
I really tried not to, and in the end, it was at the end of 2008. I had to commit all of my reserve capital to Tesla. That wasn't allocated to SpaceX, and I felt I had to sort of steer the ship directly. But it was really not fun, super not fun.
Yeah, I remember. When we talked, I guess maybe the next year after that, you said, you know, this is not at the fun level, running these two companies.
No, I mean, it's definitely gotten a lot better. Mm-hmm. With SpaceX, you know, since we've now had five successful launches in a row and we're able to dock with the space station, and with Tesla, we're able to raise enough capital to get the company to be able to produce the Model S and do the IPO. And I've got a much stronger team, a lot of bench strength at both companies. I can go from essentially almost every waking hour being spent on the companies to 90%, which is a big difference, actually.
Is the ambition still to find another CEO for one or the other?
I expect to run both companies for the foreseeable future, because I've made a commitment to people at both companies to do that. Mm-hmm. Will I be running both companies forever? I think that's unlikely, but certainly for the foreseeable future, I will be.
Is there one that has your heart more than the other one?
They both do have my heart, I think that there may come a point, several years in the future, where the fundamental good that Tesla is trying to accomplish, which is to serve as a catalyst for the acceleration of sustainable transport, has been accomplished. In other words, that's really if you look at it from an historical standpoint, what's important here in affecting the world, it's to what degree is Tesla serving as a catalyst for the advent of electric vehicles? Mm-hmm. At some point, you know, when most cars being manufactured are electric, then that will have been accomplished, and the catalytic value of Tesla will have been realized, and there'll be diminishing returns in that regard. And I think at that point, I would not need to run the company.
Can we talk a little bit about, across the companies, your experience with venture capitalists? Because it's been pretty varied, right?
Yes.
So you've had good experiences and you've had not so good experiences. Is that fair to say?
I've had a wide, wide range, yes.
What would you advise entrepreneurs watching this or in the audience to make sure they don't They don't live through what you did in the bad experiences. And can you tell us about the bad experience?
Well, I think one thing that's important is if you have a choice of a lower valuation with someone you really like, or a higher valuation with someone you have a question mark about, take the lower valuation. It's better to have a higher quality venture capitalist who you think would be great to work with than to get a higher valuation with someone where there's even a question mark, really. You know, I think that's important. It's sort of like getting married, you know. I don't know. Well, maybe I haven't been that good at that. But
you probably
learned. 10 years okay. I mean, it's not too bad.
Did you do that wrong? Did you maximize for valuation?
I suppose in the case of the Tesla Series C, I mean, at some point, I think I'll tell the full story, but
not tonight.
But not tonight.
They did wait an hour.
Right. No, I know. Well, I'll tell part of the story. So, there were multiple competing bids, but there were two competing bids. One was from Kleiner Perkins, the other one was from Vantage Point. Kleiner offered $50 million pre-money. Vantage Point offered $70 million. I actually said to John Durer that if John joins the board, mm-hmm. we'll do it at 50. John felt that there was that he had too many obligations, mm-hmm. and that there was another partner at Kleiner who really wanted the deal, and so he could not supplant that person. I thought, well, we could do. I would be okay if John Durer joined. I mean, there's a 40% difference. That difference is pretty significant. I thought if John would be willing to join the board, then we could do that, but not if it was somebody else. Mm-hmm. That was probably a mistake.
Mm-hmm. And so then they did Fisker instead, which.
And that was their mistake.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. I hope they live past the election.
Fisker and A123 are both having a lot of issues.
Yeah.
What has Tesla done that it hasn't fallen in that bucket? Looking back, there a crossroads where you made a right choice that has put you guys so far? I mean, you're not profitable yet, but in a different category.
Tesla is a really different company to Fisker. I mean, Tesla is a hardcore technology company, and we do really serious engineering. And I think you only build value in a company if you're doing hard work to solve tough problems. That's why companies are valuable, or it's why they should be valuable, and largely is why they're valuable. Mm-hmm. So, we do real manufacturing as well. I mean, the Model S coils of aluminum and plastic pellets come in, and cars come out. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do real hardcore manufacturing, quite vertically integrated. We did all the vehicle engineering, all the powertrain engineering, all the software, we also of course do the styling and design of the car. We've got a great design studio. Our head of design, Franz von Holzhausen, is awesome. Mm-hmm. In the case of Fisker, it was headed by Henrik Fisker, and he's a designer, so he's good at sort of the styling of the cars. But he thinks it's all about styling, mm-hmm. and it's not. Mm-hmm. The reason we don't have electric cars is not for lack of styling.
Right. at the time when you were getting started with Tesla, the Valley was trying to take a turn back towards science and towards saving the world. You had Kleiner Perkins, Coastal Ventures, a lot of these big firms really getting aggressive about clean tech and saying that was going to be the next internet. That has not been the case.
Right.
Why did clean tech not work for the Valley?
Well, I think the jury's out on clean tech. I think as far as Tesla and SolarCity are certainly clean tech, or I'd say, I think of it more like sustainable energy stuff. I think sustainable energy is a better, it's a little bit more of a mouthful, but it's more accurate than clean tech. I think Tesla is going to be an extremely valuable company in the long term. And
what have you done differently? Because a lot of VCs have said, well, the problem with clean tech is you have to rely on subsidies, and if you have to rely on subsidies, it's never going to work. I mean, people buying a Tesla in part get a subsidy, it takes down the price, I assume, with SolarCity. So it's like that hasn't been a knock against you guys. Like, why have these two companies worked when so many other ones haven't?
I think it's, you know, in any industry, there are only a few companies that kind of get big and succeed. I don't know. I think it just seems that in the case of Tesla, we were focused on making great products solving hard engineering problems. I mean, as evidence in Tesla for the fact that we solve hard engineering problems is the fact that Toyota and Daimler and Mercedes, you know, buy electric powertrains from us. I mean, if this was easy, they would just do it.
Right.
So we focused on solving really hard engineering problems at Tesla. You know, like I said, that contrasts with Fisker to some degree. And then at SolarCity, SolarCity does everything except the panel. So what a lot of people don't realize is that the solar panel, if it's a standard efficiency solar panel, the difficulty of manufacturing that is about as hard as manufacturing drywall. It's really easy. I mean, it seemed to me pretty obvious that in the long term we'd see cutthroat competition between silicon PV manufacturers in China, Japan, Germany, and other places, much as you see this competition in the DRAM market. I think the PV market and the DRAM market are very similar. That cost would be driven down to a very low number, approaching the raw material cost, really. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much what happened. So the real cost of solar and real challenge with solar is what's called balance of system. It's everything except the panel. The cost per installed watt for a residential system might be around $4 now, which is a big drop from where it was a few years ago. It used to be sort of $7, $8. Now it's sort of kind of half that. But the optimization really has to be at everything except the panel, because the panels are dropping now to like 90 cents a watt.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, over $3 of the $4 is balance of system, which includes the customer ownership experience, the designing the system particularly to a particular rooftop, installing it, the wiring, the inverter, after sales service, figuring out the financing financing of it all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's in the same way that say Dell doesn't make the CPU or the hard drive or the RAM or anything, but they kind of design the system and they manage the customer experience, and that's kind of how SolarCity is.
Mm-hmm.
So when I looked at the problem of solar power, that's what it looked like to me.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why SolarCity is working on the problems that it's working on, and it's doing super well you know, 90% of the credit, 95% of the credit due to Linda and Peter Rive and the rest of the team at SolarCity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You've said, I think this is the first time I've interviewed you and you haven't said it, that being an entrepreneur is like standing on the edge of an abyss, looking into abyss and chewing broken glass.
Yeah, actually that's a phrase from a friend of mine, Bill Lee, who is an early internet entrepreneur, has done a number of things since.
Mm-hmm.
The phrase that he uses is like starting a company is like it's like chewing glass and staring into the abyss.
Right. So I flipped it.
Yeah. I mean, there's a point which obviously it's not that way.
Do you still feel like that, or is
no,
it easy
now? The staring into the abyss part is just, you know, are you facing imminent death? And we certainly were at SpaceX and Tesla and SolarCity for a long time. We're no longer staring into the abyss, which is great. There's always going to be some amount of glass that's got to be chewed. It's never zero, but it's less and less as time goes by.
So less glass and no more abyss.
Yeah, the abyss is kind of there in the distance, but I'm not staring right at it.
It's in your peripheral vision.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you guys did PayPal, which was, you know, obviously started at a time when there was a lot of money and there were advantages, but, you know, compared to other .coms, it was a very hard company to build. And then you go on to do
these
others.
It was a hard company to keep alive. Yeah.
Right.
As you point out, I mean, PayPal got started in, like, late 98 to early 99. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a sort of merger of two companies, X.com that I started and Confinity that Max and Peter started, and we started to come, sort of pool our resources and tackle the problem together. Mm-hmm. But we went from starting the company to less than 18 months later, maybe it was 14 months later or something, having a valuation of $500 million. You know, these days, you know, in the, after you see some of the, things like the recent acquisition by Facebook, you think, oh, well,
Instagram,
you know, maybe that's not that great. but at the time, it was like, this is completely ridiculous.
Did you feel that way, though? Because I know there were some people inside the company who thought, why are we only worth $500 million?
I thought it was completely ridiculous. I mean, the NASDAQ peaked, I think, in March or thereabouts of 2000.
Right.
And that's around when we did the valuation for $500 million. The challenge was really keeping the company alive for the next 2 years, roughly, until it was sold to eBay.
What is you and Peter's relationship like, and what was it like then? There's a lot of stories that the two of you guys did not get along in that merger.
We've had our disagreements. But we are friends, I would say for 95% of the time we've known each other, we've been friends.
I bet that 5% was rough, though, knowing both of you.
It was a little rough. Yeah, things were a little bumpy at one point. I have more tolerance for risk than Peter does. So I was sort of maybe more kind of pedal to the metal, and Peter was like, well, let's be a little cautious here. He may have been right, actually. So,
mm-hmm. Which is ironic, since he encouraged you to gun your car that made you guys go hitchhike to
Sequoia. I don't think that was what he had in mind. I'm probably slightly more risk tolerant than Peter is. But between all of us, we managed to make PayPal work, which is that was the important thing.
But back to the abyss and the broken glass. I mean, do you only enjoy this if you're just the odds are failure?
No. No, I'm liking life more and more, actually, as there's less staring into the abyss and less glass chewing. I'm finding that to be a good thing. I hope never to return to the experiences I had in 2008 and 2009.
So I know back in, I think it was 2008, you talked about if you were to start other companies, one that you had an idea for was a electric plane that could take off and land vertically.
Yeah.
Are you now like, fuck no, I am not starting another company? Or are you still thinking
yes,
that?
Yes, that's how I feel. That is. I mean, there are three things that I think, arguably four, that I think could be done. I think I could probably do it, maybe, you know, have a better than even chance of success. One is the an electric jet, sort of. This would be kind of something cool, because one of the things that I guess where these things tend to come from is like I'll read something that seems like a sad thing in technology, and they're mm-hmm. like, well, how could we make it not a sad thing? So when I read about the Concorde being retired, and I was like, oh, geez, you know, we don't even have supersonic transport. That's terrible. Mm-hmm. And I actually didn't have a chance to fly on the Concorde, so that just seemed like a terrible thing. So initially I thought, well, I started reading up about it, and I read that the Concorde was really designed in the 60s, and, mm-hmm. and so aerodynamics have improved a great deal with computational fluid dynamics. Engine efficiency has improved massively, and even if you just changed the engines on the Concorde, you could double the range. Mm-hmm. Or thereabouts, and So then I thought, well, okay, what if you were to figure out a really efficient design that could make it economically competitive to have a supersonic aircraft? And then I started looking at it more and more, and then as I started doing the math on all of it, it seemed like, well, you just really want to go higher and higher. Mm-hmm. You know, the lower you are in the atmosphere, the more drag you have. Atmospheric density decays exponentially. So as you go up, your air density just drops dramatically, and it's really easy to go fast. And I mean, and your speed is just a force balance. It's whatever the output thrust of the engine is, balanced against the drag that you're experiencing. Mm-hmm. So as you go higher, you just go faster for the same force. Mm-hmm. And then there's a slight outward acceleration you experience, which is also slightly helpful, like a satellite. You know, when a satellite's going Mach 25, it just goes on forever once it's out of the atmosphere. So anyway, this is maybe slightly laborious, but an electric fan gets better. An electric aircraft gets better the higher you go, mm-hmm. Whereas a combustion aircraft does not. You start starving it from oxygen, mm-hmm. The air is mostly nitrogen. Mm-hmm. So as you're going through the air, you're sort of sucking in all this nitrogen, which is kind of slowing you down, and then you're trying to combust oxygen anyway. So with combustion aircraft, you hit an optimal altitude that's in the sort of 35 to maybe 55 max mm-hmm. altitude, whereas an electric aircraft, you'd want to go at like maybe 80,000 feet. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's a long way of saying you can get super efficient and super fast with an electric aircraft, and vertical takeoff and landing works well with being supersonic. I think you can make a really breakthrough aircraft that's several generations right. beyond what currently exists.
But are you going to do that?
Not anytime soon. It's possible that I may do it at some point in the future, because between SpaceX and Tesla, I kind of have the ingredients. So it's very tempting.
It'd be easy after those.
Yeah. But I think maybe it's worth considering in a few years. That's one idea. Then there's, I think we could really improve transport by having a prefabricated kind of double decker. Actually, what would really make sense is a steel box beam over the center divider, mm-hmm. with a lane on the inside and a lane on top. Mm-hmm. That's made in prefabricated sections and installed down the center divider, and you can get two lanes, and you can have the traffic be, you know, all one way or all the other,
right.
And massively improve life in places like Los Angeles, where I was just stuck in traffic going,
right.
took me an hour to go 3 miles. So I don't know who's in charge of the damn 405 construction, but they're a bloody idiot. And I hate them. It is the worst construction project I've ever witnessed in my life. I curse them daily.
Okay, so that's two. What are the other two you would do?
The third one would be, I think you could make fusion work. I mean magnetic confinement fusion. Mm-hmm. You know, relatively standard fusion, if you will. And then the fourth one,
photo sharing app, right? Subscription commerce in a box.
Absolutely. The fourth one I'm considering just open sourcing. You know, basically just describing the idea, saying this is what would be done, and if somebody wants to do it, then they can do it. But I'm thinking, like, maybe I should patent it and then offer to open source the patent to anyone that can make a credible case that they could actually do it. So I'm sort of debating it, but it would be for a fifth mode of transport. So right now of terrestrial transport, we've got planes, trains, automobiles, and boats, mm-hmm. For getting around Earth. But what if there was a fifth mode? Mm-hmm. I have a name for it, which is called the Hyperloop.
The Hyperloop?
Hyperloop, yeah.
Is it like a Jetsons tunnel?
It's something like that, yeah.
Like you just get in it, whisks you?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a characteristic. So this is partly prompted by the California train thing. Like, yeah. We know we've got like a bullet train that's like this, it has the dubious distinction of being the slowest bullet train and the most expensive per mile.
Go California.
We got some superlatives there. So we're setting records at both ends of the wrong ends of the spectrum, and apparently it's gonna be like $60 billion or something to go from San Francisco to LA, and if they're saying 60 now, it's gonna be more later.
Right.
And of course, it's a really slow train.
To put this in perspective, 100 million got you into space.
Well, it got me started. I mean, it certainly got me to space. Didn't quite get me into
billion.
Orbit. Very close. Yes, something like that. Yeah. In terms of venture capital investment, it's been a couple hundred million total, including outside investors.
Mm-hmm.
So, and SpaceX has been profitable for the last few years. So, I think we can do something that's probably 10% of the cost. And I try to think of what are the attributes that you'd want in a new mode of transport. In fact, what is the theoretically fastest way that you could get from LA to San Francisco?
Mm-hmm.
And so the system I have in mind, which is you're guessing in the right direction. How would you like something that can never crash?
Mm-hmm.
It is immune to weather. It goes three or four times faster than the sort of bullet train that's being built.
Your supersonic jet.
Well, it goes about, let's say, an average speed of twice what an aircraft would do. So you go from downtown LA to downtown San Francisco in under 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And it would cost you much less than an air ticket or car, much less than any other mode of transport, because the fundamental energy cost is so much lower. And I think we could actually make it self-powering if you just if you put solar panels on it. You generate, my rough back of the envelope is, you generate more power than you consume in the system, and there's a way to store the power so that it would run 24/7 without using batteries. So there's different ways to store energy. Anyway, so that's...
You think this is possible? This is not just...
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Wow. Is there ever a time you retire? You have 5 children.
Right.
You ever just want to hang out with the kids?
Yes, I do. I do want to hang out with the kids. I don't want to retire, but I do want to hang out with the kids. My goal is to retire right before senility. It's tough.
See, it's like being
your
crazy.
Judgment starts
like,
to be impaired. Yeah, it's like getting hypoxia. You don't realize your decisions suck until you're dead. So I don't intend to retire. Maybe at 80 or something. It would be cool to be born on Earth and die on Mars.
Yeah, you said before you want to retire on Mars. Is this more or less feasible?
I was asked, it's more like if I were to retire, it's not like I want to retire, but if I were to retire on the verge of senility, I'd like it to be on Mars. That would be cool.
It's funny because you were saying earlier that you're slightly more risk-taking than Peter. Peter wants to be on a boat that's like an island out somewhere that has no laws. You want to be on Mars. It is the slightly riskier, crazy version.
Yeah. I think Peter entertains a lot of interesting ideas. I'm not sure he necessarily wants to be on an island offshore. Last time I saw him, he was in San Francisco. But I think he likes to, he sort of entertains interesting ideas, and he's not bound by convention, certainly.
That's for sure. All right, well, we want to get some questions from the audience. So we've got a couple microphones, if anyone wants to line up. While we're waiting on people, you're an investor in Stripe, and...
A very tiny investor. Very tiny investor, and I have no idea what they're doing.
wow, I know. This is the only subject where I know more than you.
Okay.
I talked to them the other day. But which leads me to the question, do you think PayPal is finally screwed?
Well, if PayPal doesn't do something, it will be screwed, yes.
There has not been a lot of innovation.
No, in fact, if you look at the product plan that I wrote in 2000, there's hardly any difference. In fact, it's slightly worse than that.
You've gone backwards.
Yeah. I mean, PayPal should be where all the money is.
Yeah, and it's not.
It's definitely not.
All right, go ahead.
Hi there. I first wanted to thank you, Sarah, for believing in LA. I was actually up at one of the events in San Francisco, and I think we have 2 to 3 times as many people here. So thank you.
It is the same. It's actually 100 people fewer than we fit in our San Francisco venue, but it sold out the fastest.
All right.
So Ben Horowitz sold out in about 4 hours, and you sold out in 3.
All right.
And you have a writer here, Michael, so thank you for believing in LA.
I think we are the only blog with a full-time writer here.
There you go. My question is for you, Alon. First of all, thank you for doing these big things to, you know, improve humanity. I worked for Space Adventures when I was in college.
All right, cool, yeah.
And I really believe in the space frontier, the abyss, so to speak.
the good abyss, yeah.
But indeed. But just thinking about LA for a moment, what do you think we can do to improve the ecosystem here in LA?
Well, I think better freeways would be huge. Honestly, I wish there was like, who do I complain to about the freeways? Somebody's got to be responsible for it.
Don't do that. I'd rather you build jets and hyperloops than be the mayor of LA.
But I think if somebody could, seriously, it's like if improving the transport system, that's got to be, for anyone that lives in LA, what's going to be the number one gripe? It's the damn highways.
I tried to run a startup to do that, but no one would fund me.
Yeah.
Endinggridlock.org.
I'm open to funding someone if they want to do the box beam thing over the center divider, which would be, I mean, a regulatory challenge, but I think you can get people to vote for it. I vote for it in like 3 seconds. And it's just, you got to do it in a way that it doesn't impede the existing traffic flow. And so it's got to be prefabricated sections that just get dropped in place like Lego.
Mm-hmm. Why did you move to LA?
Because the Southern California has the biggest concentration of aerospace engineers in the world.
Oh.
And it was a choice. I lived in the Bay Area for 10 years and lived in Palo Alto. I lived like three blocks away from the PayPal office. That's why PayPal is on University Avenue, because I lived on Forest.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really convenient. So I moved down to LA just because the odds of success with a rocket company were pretty low to begin with. And if I insisted that experienced aerospace engineers move from Southern California to the Bay Area and kind of leave their job mm-hmm. and buy a house in the Bay Area, which is really expensive,
right.
then the odds of success would be decreased even further. So that's why I moved to LA is
All right.
Yeah.
I want to try to get through as many of these questions as possible, but because we do not have Elon for much longer. So let's ask him real quick and answer real quick. Okay?
All right.
Okay.
Hey, Elon. Huge fan of yours. So thank you so much for inspiring young entrepreneurs all over the world. Quick question. One of the area of innovation is in the area of education, right? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on what are some of the ways that we can disrupt or in the area of education.
Right. Well, what Sebastian Thrun is doing and Salman Khan, I mean, I think that's real. That stuff is really disruptive. So what Sebastian Thrun and Khan are doing is that's great stuff, sort of online learning. And I think there's to the degree that you can gamify learning, I think that's really helpful. You want to make learning not a chore. If people are drawn to it, like they're drawn to video games, then I think that would really help.
What do you think about Peter's whole getting people to drop out of college thing?
I think going to college is entirely optional. I mean, it's if you've got a good idea, I'd say drop out and try it out. Mm-hmm. You can always go back to college.
It's always there.
Yeah.
All right.
Honda, Mercedes have both sort of said to me very clearly they feel hydrogen and fuel cells are the future, but I believe strongly in batteries. I know. Why do you think they're so committed to hydrogen as like the next step, whereas batteries, I really feel like we can make this happen?
I don't really know, because the math is so super obviously in favor of batteries that it's like staring facts in the face and saying they're not true. If you take the best case scenario for a fuel cell and you say, forget about, it's like assume it's fully optimized. So you're you can you you know, can envelope it from a physics standpoint and say and give it the best case situation. How does that compare to state-of-the-art lithium ion or current lithium ion in production? And it loses. So it's like success is not one of the possible outcomes. Why embark upon that? It's crazy. I think part of it is like they felt for a long time that there was this need to be doing something. And since fuel cells were 10 years in the future and always would be, then they could always say they're working on fuel cells and that would satisfy people.
You don't have to deliver.
Yeah. Tesla called it fool cells.
All right, great. Go ahead.
Hey there. My name is Richard Cooperstein. I was an early executive at Facebook, where I headed up all of the international business development, corporate development, and strategy. And so, you know, thinking big was something that, you know, has been a part of my DNA from those days and before. And so as I look at all the things that you've been building, obviously it resonates very much. So in order to build the things that you're building, obviously you need sources of capital, and you have, you know, a sort of network of people around you. I recently partnered with a group called LiquidNet, and they think about providing liquidity on a nine-figure and up kind of basis. And they've created this really dynamic platform where they have 700 partners who all have an average of $20 billion under management, which equals about $14 trillion. And what they're trying to do is identify really tremendous technology companies, biotech, pharma, and that kind of thing, and space being sort of the next frontier. My question to you is, where do you think, you know, the next big buckets of efficiency are for you in your capital formation efforts vis-a-vis, you know, really finding that way to Mars and finding that way to kind of create the next wave of humanity out in the wider universe? And, you know, we have a platform that provides for that. My question is where do you find, you know, efficient sources of capital, or is a platform like what we have something that would serve your needs?
Well, in my case, I find the public markets to be a pretty effective source of capital. It's worked out well for Tesla. And SolarCity will probably go public later this year. And SpaceX could go public at any point. SpaceX has been cash flow positive for a few years, so it doesn't really need additional capital. So actually, as far as I'm concerned, I at this point I do not feel myself to be capital constrained.
But going public is more efficient for you than sort of staying private, you know, thinking about what's been happening in the public markets and sort of the gyrations and the need for public disclosure and all that kind of stuff. You think that's more efficient?
Yeah, I actually don't find it to be too much of a problem to be a public company. And I mean, I kind of run the private companies like they're public companies in terms of, you know, having the appropriate controls in place and mechanisms for effective governance. I don't think it's actually that bad to be a public company, unless you're going to sort of get really concerned about the day-to-day fluctuations in the stock price. So as long as you just say, look, it's the stock price is going to fluctuate day to day, and I don't care, then you know that's the only time it's an issue. You just shouldn't worry about the day-to-day fluctuations too much.
What do you think about the trend of the dual class shares and this whole idea, like being pushed by Andreessen Horowitz and others, of basically you need a fortress to go public?
I think there can be some merit to a dual class. I mean, Tesla has a single class, and there's some merit to a dual class. I think it can be taken to a bit of an extreme in some cases where it's a dual class or one class basically doesn't count.
Right.
I think that's probably a bit unreasonable. There needs to be some path towards ultimately, I think, having a single class, mm-hmm. because you just get the succession problem.
Right.
And it's just rare that, say, somebody's successor, particularly if that's still their kid, is the right person. It does happen, but it's unusual. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there are cases where it's been well managed. Say, like with Ford. Like Ford was the only company not to go bankrupt, and one could argue that the Ford family was a stabilizing influence on the company, and had more long-term thinking. Mm-hmm. Like I said, I think there's merits to having a dual class of ownership, as long as it's not taken to an extreme.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm getting a sign that we can only take one more question.
Yeah, so, and I apologize. I'm actually supposed to be at a screening for a film about Haiti, and that's actually where I inadvertently went first.
Oh, no.
And why I was so late.
Oh, no.
So I absolutely have to show up there.
All right.
Because it's...
So I apologize, you guys, but you're getting the last one.
All right. So I work in the space industry out here as well, so I appreciate the things you're doing with SpaceX. You tweeted yesterday that you thought we were going to be at Mars in 40 years, and we haven't been to the moon in 40 years, so I was wondering what SpaceX's plan is for that.
Yeah, actually, I was saying that I thought we could conceivably be at Mars around 12 to 15 years from now. SpaceX is continuing to develop the technology beyond Falcon 9, Falcon Heavy, on paper at least, I think we've got a system that could achieve Mars colonization. There's a long way from having such a system on paper or electronically, really. I don't really have it on paper. And actually making it real. But it was only maybe a year or two ago that, less than 2 years ago, that I concluded that it was possible to create a self-sustaining civilization on Mars.
So I read earlier a quote from you that said that Mars was just this side of impossible. Or is it further than this side of impossible?
No, I believe it's possible, just extremely difficult.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but I wasn't sure it was possible until about a year and a half ago.
Uh-huh. So last thing, we always ask everybody a series of questions, and the crowd favorite is always, what would be your mediocre superpower? Now, this is absurd to ask you because Tony Stark is partially modeled after you.
Right.
So you actually are sort of have real. So we haven't actually
downgrade.
Well, he
doesn't technically have a superpower, except like inventing technology or something.
Right. So we're sort of asking you to downgrade from that a bit. So an example of a mediocre superpower would be one of the best ones we've ever gotten is this guy who wished to temporarily detach his arm while spooning with a girl. Sometimes it's staying.
That's what he wants to do with a girl.
That's awesome. Sometimes it's like staying perfectly caffeinated. That's some people's. The other day, my nanny had a great one, which was to inflict menstrual cramps on her enemies.
Wow. Okay.
So, what would yours be?
A mediocre superpower.
Mm-hmm. So it can't.
Because
be
I think
like...
the most awesome superpower would just be to be lucky.
One would say you have been.
Yeah.
So if you could dial that back slightly.
What would be a good mediocre superpower? I think you're talking mediocre superpowers here. I think to always beat the traffic.
I think that's an appropriate way to end tonight.
Right.
So just a couple housekeeping things. We're not going to do LA monthly, but we are going to do it regularly. So we'll do two or three more of these before the end of the year, and we will try to have as impressive guests as Elon. We have a couple in mind already that I think will be surprising. If anyone would like to sponsor these events, we are a for-profit company, and we're trying to make money. You can email me at sarah@pandodaily.com, and I will get you to the right people. As you can see, it's an amazing event. You should absolutely give us money so we can keep doing it and pay people like Michael who cover LA companies. Next week, if you're in San Francisco, we have Mark Pincus. We would love to see you there. And other than that, let's just give a huge round of applause to Elon.
Feeling stressed, left without gravity, in an environment that gets more and more complicated and complex every day? Untangle your mind and go back to the roots of clear thinking. Get the original text of The Leviathan by Hobbes, The Two Treatises of Government by Locke, The Social Contract by Rousseau, plus the U.S. Constitution from Pennsylvania, bound together into just one practical book. That's right, Hobbes, Locke, Rousseau, and the U.S. Constitution, bound together into just one practical book to keep your costs low.